Hi, everybody. Welcome to Mailin' It, the official podcast of the United States Postal Service. I'm Carla Kirby.
And I'm Jonathan Castillo. It's becoming something of a tradition here on Mailin' It to talk about National Consumer Protection Week every year around this time. There's a good reason for that. The Postal Inspection Service plays a very important role in fighting fraud and other crimes that can happen to any one of us. In the past, we've covered work-from-home schemes and romance scams as part of the National Consumer Protection Week. This time, we're going to focus on investment fraud.
Specifically, this episode, we're speaking with Eric Shin, Inspector in Charge at the Postal Inspection Service's Criminal Investigations Group, about some of the investment scams he's seeing out there and how people can protect themselves and their loved ones from becoming victims. Eric, welcome to Mailin' It.
Thank you for having me.
Eric, before we get into our conversation about National Consumer Protection Week and fraud prevention, it would be great if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. How long have you been with the Postal Inspection Service?
I have been with the Postal Inspection Service for about 18 years. For the last 2 years, I have been in my current position as the inspector in charge of the Criminal Investigations Group. Before that, my 16 years of my career was always in Los Angeles, California, kind of where I grew up as well. Recently moved out here a couple of years ago.
Tell us a little about your background in law enforcement. Are financial crimes your specialty at the Inspection Service?
Yes. Before coming to Washington, D.C. in my current position, I worked in Los Angeles. And during the 16 years there, when I was working cases, I worked majority cases of financial crimes involving mail theft, identity theft, bank fraud, mail fraud. When I became a team leader, I supervised a team of inspectors and task force members for a financial crimes identity theft task force. When I became an assistant inspector in charge, I oversaw the mail fraud programs, the security programs, and the mail theft programs that all involved those aspects of financial crimes.
So a lot of the scams these days are reaching people through email and text and other digital channels. What's the connection between this type of criminal behavior and the Postal Inspection Service?
Well, Carla and Jonathan, as you know, the mail reaches everyone in this country and abroad as well. A lot of these scams involve sending or receiving money via the mail. Then they're part of the Inspection Service jurisdiction once the mail is being utilized to facilitate these criminal activities. Also, sometimes people are asked to mail a crypto wallet. It's a trend over the past 5 years. Crypto wallets, if you don't know what they are, they're really a size of maybe a USB thumb drive, something to that aspect that has digital currency in it. It's very easy to mail, small. It's hard to locate when you can hide it in other items in the mail. So it's definitely something that we're seeing in a trend now. It's harder to trace when you're using cryptocurrency. And there's always an element of mail-in investment fraud as well when you're looking at these types of financial crimes.
And we mentioned it a little bit earlier, this year you're focused on investment fraud. For our listeners who maybe are like me, might not be familiar with the term, what exactly is investment fraud? What does that even mean?
So investment fraud's been going on for a long time. I think it's just becoming, unfortunately, worse because of social media and the internet. There's a lot more opportunities. There's a lot more reach with social media and the internet. A lot of these examples I can give you is get-rich-quick schemes or investment opportunities like bogus securities or commodities, oil wells, rare coins, cryptocurrency. Usually a request of money typically follows, which is a big red flag that someone's being targeted for a scam.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to give us some real-world examples of what these investment scams might look like?
Sure. Between 2009 and 2018, a businessman named Frederick Voigt told investors he was looking to invest in companies with innovative products. He led people to believe he was going to invest their money in specific companies. Most of the money he received went to his own pockets, of course. And he also used the money from the new investors to pay the existing investors, which is the classic Ponzi scheme that we've seen, throughout the history. When investors didn't receive the payments, they thought that they pretty much expected he was caught. So, you know, it continued to go on until the investigation kind of come to fruition. He was sentenced in 2022 to over 5 years in federal prison, and he was ordered to pay almost $41 million in restitution. In another Ponzi example I can give you that we've investigated as an agency is a con artist pretending to be the CEO of a New York investment firm. He, again, very similar to these schemes, defrauded the investors out of more than $4 million through a financial service firm that he controlled. He lied to the investors about how much money had been raised, who had invested, how close the firm was to an IPO, and how he would use investors' money. He took most of the money for his own use or to pay off investors in a Ponzi-like fashion. And he was, of course, once investigated, sentenced to prison.
So based on some information I looked at, Ponzi schemes and the U.S. mail have a long history, more than 100 years. They're named for Charles Ponzi, who used coupons issued by the Postal Service to defraud investors shortly after World War I ended. There's a longer story here, of course, but the short of it is that postal inspectors ending up nailing him in 1920, and he was sentenced to 5 years in jail. Eric, you mentioned cryptocurrency earlier. I thought that type of financial transaction was done digitally. Do you have any examples of cryptocurrency investigation that involved Postal Service Inspection Service?
Absolutely. And just like any type of scam, it could be a romance scam or a financial type of scam. As long as there's money involved, we are starting to see that trend where they're asking for digital currency instead. But it's not just those types of things. So something specific that you know, is almost like in your backyard, right? A Colorado pastor was recently charged with convincing followers to buy millions of dollars worth of cryptocurrency called index coin. He and his wife allegedly offered index coin through an online cryptocurrency exchange they created, controlled, and operated. They raised more than $3 million from more than 300 people that really trusted them. You know, he's a pastor. You expect going to church, you would trust this person, right? But the couple, they spent at least $1.3 million of the money they received on jewelry, vacations, airline tickets, clothing, and remodeling their homes. So once they're, again, identified, investigated, going through the judicial process, all their assets were frozen, and all the people behind Index Coin are being prosecuted currently.
Wow. Just what a terrible, you know, abuse of trust there. Tell me, what makes these investment scams so difficult for the victims to see through?
Well, you know, they try to make these schemes very realistic. You know, we've seen ones where they actually rented a physical office space, hired a receptionist. You know, they position themselves as investment counselors, and they distribute professionally designed mailers to describe their offering. And they use really well-rehearsed scripts to be convincing, utilizing social media, utilizing the mail, utilizing emails, creating those the facade of the investments. And they target older people because older people have the money saved up from their, you know, their retirement. And they may be less savvy about investments. So there may be more in line to falling for those things. And we're also seeing a trend with cryptocurrency. A lot of younger adults in their early ages of, you know, 20s, mid-30s, that are falling for these scams, get-rich-quick scams involving cryptocurrency, trying to make money. And a lot of times, it's, you know, like mentioning the pastors, trusted friends or family members that could be potentially behind the scam. Even experienced investors can be caught up in a clever investment scam. Example I can give you is professional money managers who place their clients' money with Bernie Madoff. That's something that's very much in the news that everyone has seen, and it's definitely another reason why these investment scams seem so realistic when you have these names or well-known people involved.
So it's interesting that scammers will go to great lengths to appear legitimate, especially when they can reach so many people with just a social media account, a website, and an email address. Can you give us an example of a case where it would have been really difficult for even an experienced investor to know that they were being caught up in a fraud?
Absolutely. An example I can give you is the Nikola Motor Company. The CEO of the parent company, Trevor Milton, he encouraged investment in companies' plans to produce hydrogen, build hydrogen plants, and manufacture hydrogen and battery-powered trucks. But he was overstating the company's potential. Ended up repeatedly lying to investors via social media, TV, podcasts, and in print. And instead of launching an initial public offering, he merged Nikola into what's called a special purpose acquisition company. This sidesteps certain regulations aimed at governing IPOs and the public statements the CEO makes. Milton was convicted of securities and wire fraud and was sentenced to 4 years in federal prison with 3 years of supervised release. He was ordered to forfeit his property, received a $1 million fine, and he has to pay the restitution back to the investors.
Eric, when we were preparing for this episode, I remember you mentioned that some people have a really hard time being convinced that they're actually a victim of investment fraud. Why is that?
Well, these con men are very slick, very good at what they do. Sometimes people are scammed by family, friends, other people they trust, like the pastor in Colorado that I mentioned earlier. Sometimes people are so convinced by a fraudster that those victims recruit other victims. And it's really hard to understand the victim's mindset. An example I can give you is a personal example. When I went to talk to a victim of a financial scheme, she didn't believe me, and she actually called the police on me. So I had to get her family involved, her daughter involved, to really convince them, her, that this investment that she was putting her life savings into was bogus.
Mm. So, Eric, I can remember this one time a few years back, right? My partner at the time got this phone call, and they were asking, basically saying, hey, your taxes, you owe this much in taxes, and, you're going to get penalties, and if you don't pay now, you can serve jail time and things like that. So I remember getting that phone call, answering it, and I was going along with it at first. I mean, they were so convincing. And then they just kept asking for a little bit more information. I thought, wait a second, these are red flags here. Like you talked about, this is a red flag. And finally I caught eye before I gave them any of the good information. But I think the point is, it's not just, the elderly that are being targeted here. They go after anybody, and it can really, if you're not paying attention, if you're distracted, because I think at that time I was a little distracted, it can affect young people, old people, anyone.
Absolutely. And I think that's the point. They target everybody and anybody and try to catch you off guard. I can tell you myself, like I mentioned earlier, 18 years in federal law enforcement with the Postal Inspection Service. A couple of days ago, I received a solicitation in the mail about, notice you purchased this on Amazon, write a review, scan this QR code, provide your personal information, and we'll send you a $30 gift card. And I first read it, I'm like, oh, $30 gift card, I could use that. But then I did a double take, and I even showed my wife, like, this has got to be a scam, right? And she's like, oh, yeah. And then we just ripped it up and threw it in the trash. But, it really is. They target anyone and anybody, and they will go after whoever is going to kind of take the bait a little bit. So you have to be really diligent when you see things come through the mail, phone calls, emails, texts. They use everything and anything to reach out to the public.
They're using QR codes now?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Usually, like when you see a QR code on a mail piece, you feel like it's mm-hmm. pretty legit.
Yeah.
So that's kind of scary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They really try to take advantage of any type of new technology to scam people.
I think, people tend to, look at things, especially, I think, Eric, what you mentioned, very interesting, that they knew your Amazon purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see that, you're like, oh, this must be legitimate. So is anybody really immune to being subjected to this type of scamming?
No. You know, if you're out there as far as making purchases online, or, you know, what's popular now, right? Purchases online. So that's a good example. You know, even though you may not have ever used Amazon, they will utilize Amazon's logo. They'll create that fake letter solicitation to you and still mail it to you, hoping one of you did purchase something and then think, oh, okay, I can utilize this account. Knowing that Amazon is a popular website that everyone utilizes, you know, that's a good example. But there's other many examples. If you purchase a lot, you know, from other clothing companies or anything like that online, they just will, you know, Photoshop their logo into a letter that they create to make it as real as they can. Like, you know, I've received solicitations before, not just in the, you know, in an email as well from a bank. I received one saying, oh, your account might be been hacked. Please click on this link. And, you know, just stuff like that you're going to see. And you have to really be careful and diligent. And when that happens, first thing I do, I take out my debit card, I call the back of the number, and I ask them, did you send me information on that? And they said, no, we don't do it that way. So that's another way of kind of preventing anything further, and to educate your family, your members, you know, whoever's listening to this podcast, that's something you got to do, to be really diligent and double check, you know, when you do receive something that might seem a little off.
So that actually brings me to something that, you know, I recently received at my home. So it was a notice of breach. Mm-hmm. And it said, and there was a QR code and there was a phone number on it. But the actual vendor who said they had the breach, I didn't recognize it. But they said they worked as a sub for another vendor. And so I think that fear of, okay, it's a breach, and okay, they're going to give some consumer protection or some kind of credit monitoring. But it doesn't even click to most people that you're going to have to give them your personal information to verify who you are. It's, very disheartening.
Yeah.
So what are some ways that people can protect themselves from this type of fraud?
You know, you try to vet the person or company by searching for them online and on social media. Search online for their email address or phone number to see if info about a scam pops up. Check if an investment professional or company is licensed or registered. You can go to investor.gov, and a Commodities Futures Trading Commission websites are good resources. You can also call the Better Business Bureau, State Attorney General, or Consumer Protection Agency. Compare any information the person has given you with what you find out about them online. Never move more quickly to commit to an investment that you feel comfortable with. These are not just things that I'm mentioning to you. I actually practice these things myself.
You know, one of the problems that you pointed out a little bit earlier is that some people just have a hard time knowing when they're being scammed. How can people help protect their family, their friends?
Just being especially attentive towards younger family members who might not have a lot of experience investing, and older family members who might not have a lot of experience online. The inspection service sometimes attends AARP meetings to educate older adults about different types of fraud, because they are often targeted. If appropriate, answer the phone for older family members and relatives when you're visiting to get a sense of the types of calls coming into their homes. And if appropriate, volunteer to review their finances with them and question suspicious payments or large withdrawals. National Fraud Protection Week is a week that focuses on this, but we advocate for prevention all year long.
So definitely, let me tell you, being aware of those social media and how they really mine your information and, you know, target those ads is another key thing that I've noticed. So if someone thinks that they or someone they know has been a victim of this type of fraud, what can they do and how can they get help?
Well, if you have been targeted or fallen victim to a scam, tell a friend or family member. File a report at USPIS.gov or call 1-877-876-2455. Most of the tips and complaints come through the website, and then an investigation really starts with you reporting it. People should never feel ashamed to come forward if they are victims. Their courage can help others also becoming victims. The inspection service is working to spot investment fraud, but relies heavily on the public acting as our eyes and ears.
Before we wrap this up, Eric, I did want to ask you about a different type of fraud that's really been on the increase lately. These unsolicited mobile text messages from the Postal Service, or at least they're purporting to be from the Postal Service, and so many people are getting them. I know I'm getting them. You probably received them as well. It's not investment fraud exactly, but I think it's worth mentioning, right?
You're absolutely right, Jonathan. You are correct. I do get those probably once every other week. You know, the type of text message you're talking about is called smishing. If you never signed up for a USPS tracking request for a specific package, then don't click the link. That's what they're there for. They really want to bait you into that, to clicking on that link. Because when they do that, they are hoping that you will then provide information such as usernames and passwords, social security numbers, date of birth, credit debit card numbers, personal identifiers, or other sensitive information. These victims will typically receive a deceptive text message to lure the recipient into providing their personal financial information. So in general, people using smishing scams attempt to disguise themselves as a government agency, such as ourselves, the Postal Service, banks, or other legitimate companies. This information is then used to carry out other crimes, such as financial fraud. The Postal Service offers free tools to track specific packages, but customers are required to either register online or initiate a text message and provide a tracking number. USPS does not charge for these services. USPS will not send customers text messages or emails without a customer first requesting the service with a tracking number, and it will not contain a link.
That's key. I think that's really key because, I get those text messages, right? The ones with the smishing.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, your package is delayed or something. And then that's when they try to get all that information. And that's where they, you know, use it for other types of fraud. So
absolutely
crazy. Well, listen, Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It was great speaking with you. Great learning about all the different types of investment fraud scams that are out there and how we can help protect, our loved ones, our friends.
So definitely, thank you for joining us. Just want to clarify, so to file a report, USPIS.gov or 1-877-876-2455. And that would be for any scams that involve the Postal Service.
Correct.
Well, definitely great information. Hopefully our listeners took note. Don't click on the link.
That's right. Don't click on the link. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Thank you, Eric, so much. And now it's time for another segment of Did You Know? Where Jonathan and I discuss surprising facts about the Postal Service that most people are not aware of. I'll get things started. Jonathan, did you know that before 1913, the Postal Service wasn't allowed to deliver packages that weighed more than 4 pounds?
Wow. It's hard to believe the weight limit was ever that low.
I know. Postal employees were prohibited from accepting anything weighing more than 4 pounds. Interestingly, 4 pounds was only the limit for domestic items, but international parcels could weigh up to 11 pounds. Former Postmaster General John Wanamaker called it a curious anomaly and pushed for changes in domestic package delivery. On July 1, 1913, the Post Office Department started a new service called Parcel Post.
That is curious. Who were the first people to use the new Parcel Post?
Well, there was a bit of a race to be first. At the stroke of midnight that first day, Postmaster Ed M. Morgan in New York City and Postmaster General Hitchcock each mailed the other a package. However, these weren't the first packages to be delivered. The distinction belongs to an 11-pound container of apples sent to New Jersey Governor and President-elect Woodrow Wilson. The Woodrow Wilson Club of Princeton deposited the apples at a local post office at precisely 12:01 a.m. By pre-arrangement, the carrier who received the package raced to the president-elect's home, where at 12:04 a.m., Wilson met him at the door and signed for his apples. In the first 6 months of Parcel Post, the Post Office Department delivered 300 million packages.
Amazing. That is a lot of packages in just 6 months. My Did You Know is also related to shipping packages. Did you know that the Postal Service played a special role in helping U.S. soldiers in Europe celebrate Christmas in 1918?
No, I didn't. What was this special role?
Well, more than 2 million American military servicemen and women were stationed in Europe when the Declaration of Armistice on November 11, 1918, effectively ended World War I. Many could not return home by Christmas 1918. So with the help of the Red Cross, military and postal officials planned to deliver Christmas by mail.
Interesting. How did they do that?
During the fall of 1918, service members could request coupons to send home asking for a standardized 3-pound box of gifts. The U.S. military reported that more than 15 million parcels and packages with the special Christmas coupons arrived in Europe that December. Additionally, 46 million letters came from the U.S., while American Expeditionary Forces service personnel sent home more than 40 million letters.
Wow, that's quite an impressive amount of mail. It's wonderful to know that the Postal Service has been supporting our servicemen and women for more than 100 years. And that wraps up this edition of Did You Know?
You know, Carla, I'm so glad we had a chance to dive into all the different types of investment fraud scams that are out there. What hit home for me was something that Eric said about the victims. Sometimes it's really hard for someone to admit, even to themselves maybe, that they've been scammed, duped, hoodwinked. It's not easy. That's why it's so important as consumers, right, to educate ourselves and share this information with our friends and our loved ones. And I think it's great that the Inspection Service is so proactive on cracking down on mail-related crime, fraud, and really ensuring the sanctity of mail. Carla, as you know, last year in May, they launched a joint effort with the Postal Service, Project Safe Delivery, to enhance employee safety and strengthen consumer protections. And here they are again, helping fight investment fraud by educating the American public during National Consumer Protection Week.
You know, Jonathan, great points. I think one of the major things I took away from speaking with Eric is that really nobody is immune to these type of scams, whether it be investment, whether it be romance, text, phone, mail. There's just so many things out here that we need to be diligent about, and definitely sharing our experiences with family and friends, as well as another good thing he pointed out was Google it. If you get something, look and see, does it come up as a scam? I think that is also one of the ways that we can look to protect ourselves. So that's all for this episode of Mailin' It.
Until next delivery.
Don't forget to subscribe to Mailin' It wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss the next episode. And follow along on Instagram @U.S. Postal Service, Twitter @USPS, and on Facebook.